Thank you for the introduction and also the invitation. As you mentioned, today I'm going to talk about direct detection of subGV dark matter using a QSTMC detector. QSTMC is a short name for Quantum Enhanced Superfluid Technologies for dark matter and cosmology. And this is based on two different work packages. In Work Package 1, we are searching for the nature of dark matter, and we try to detect subGV dark matter using quantum amplified helium-3 calorimeter. In this detector, we have a bolometer filled with superfluid and instrumented with a nanowire and reading out energy deposition using quantum sensors. This allows us to reach to very low threshold and consequently leading us to search for a low dark matter mass region. In Work Package 2, we are focusing on phase transition in extreme matter and trying to simulate the early universe using helium-3 superfluid and studying phase transition between distinct quantum backward that can take place in phase A and phase B of a helium-3 superfluid, and consequently searching for gravitational wave. But this talk is only focusing on a work package one. This is a work from the collaboration between Royal Holloway, University of London, and Lancaster, Sussex, and Oxford universities. And this is the list of our core team, consists of both experimentalists and theorists. I'm in the theory sector, but today I will try to cover experimental side as well. I will start this discussion with some dark matter introduction and searches strategy, then precisely show dark matter and helium-3 interactions, differential rate, cross-section, and we'll show how we set limit over spin-dependent and spin-independent interactions. Afterward, I will move toward a general concept of QSTMC detector, which is a new technique for detecting subGV dark matter. Then I will show our projection sensitivity for spin-dependent and spin-independent interaction. And using air-shadowing effect, we'll show how we can extend up the projection sensitivity for both spin-dependent and spin-independent interactions. Okay. On a platform of astrophysical scale, there are many reasons for existence of dark matter. A very traditional one is going to galaxy rotational curves, where at very large distances from the center of galaxies, we expect to have lower velocity other than what when we observed it was higher. So this deviation can be explained with existence of more matter in the texture of galaxies. And with a similar reason for velocity dispersion of galaxies in a cluster and gravitational lensing. And if dark matter is in the form of astral neutrinos, then X-ray emission from gas in clusters are very good reasons for existence of such a particles. And a very modern evidence coming from cosmic microwave background power spectra that can account for 25% of our universe made of dark matter. And the rest are going to dark energy and baryons. There are several searches and strategies for dark matter. The first one here is indirect detection, which is based on annihilation of dark matter and production of standard model particles. These are model-independent approaches, and usually they have a lot of backgrounds. In collider searches, this process is getting reversed and is based on annihilation of standard model particles and production of dark matter. And usually they look into missing energy or momentum or even searching for heavy mediators. And these are usually model dependent. The last one, which is the foundation of QSTMC, is based on scattering of dark matter of nuclei in ray detector. And a recoiling nucleus can provide three formats of energy, like scintillation, ionization, and phonon. And these energies are proportional to the reduced mass of dark matter square, the velocity of dark matter, A square and inverse of the target and proportional to this function, which theta is the angle between recoil nucleus and dark matter. Notice a simple plot showing a maximum recoil energy in terms of dark matter mass for two different targets, helium-3, which is light, and xenon-129, which is heavy. As we can see here, for the heavier dark matter, roughly greater than 10, the xenon-129 has higher maximum recoil. So for this region of dark matter, heavier targets are more useful. But for lighter region, you see helium-3 has higher maximum recoil. So to probe lower dark matter masses, lighter targets are usually more helpful. In addition to being light, there are some other advantages for helium-3. They have very low threshold, and the energy excitation for helium-3 is in order of 10 to minus 7 electron volts, and they have very low background, especially in the case of superfluid, because they are super cold and completely pure. And helium-3 is in the form of fermion with two proton and one neutron, and it has a unpaired nucleon. That's why it's allowing us to search both for spin-dependent and spin-independent interactions. There are several models beyond the standard model that can explain sub-GB dark matter, like asymmetric dark matter, freezing, strongly interacting massive particle, hidden sector, and so on with these references. And this is the landscape of dark matter. In this region, dark matter behaves as a classical field like axion or axion-like particle. And in this region, dark matter behaves as a particle. In the blue region, where typically interacting massive particle and freeze out was the base of many traditional direct detection searches. Now, if we combine freeze out with hidden sector or even hidden sector with freezing, we can allow for lighter dark matter region. And for strongly interacting massive particles, we can have mass around electron mass. And for asymmetric dark matter, in order to keep number density of dark matter and baryons conserved, then the mass of dark matter need to be roughly smaller than 5 times of proton. And this green region here is the target of our QuestDNC detector around proton mass. And even we aim to go to lighter dark matter region. But still we are in this region, which is a unique and very motivated mass range. These are the leading sensitivities of dark matter direct detection. In the left panel, you have a spin independent dark matter nucleon interaction with leading contribution from dark side and xenon. And in the right side, you have a spin-dependent dark matter neutron interactions with leadings from xenon, CREST, CDFS, LOX, Spandau, and so on. I'm not showing here dark matter proton because it's not relevant to helium-3 interaction. I will show you the reason later. Today, I aim to show our projection sensitivity over this plot. So in order to show projection sensitivity, we need to collect three different information: signal simulation, background simulation, and detector response model. And then compiling all this information, we can find sensitivity for dark matter. Let me start with a signal simulation, which obviously we need interactions between dark matter and other particles, like standard model particles. These are most of the interactions between dark matter and standard model particles in the form of scalar-scalar, axial-axial, vector-vector, and so on. However, since we are working in direct detection experiment, it is more convenient to work in non-relativistic effective field theory, which is giving us a better description of nuclear response. Still, we follow the recipe of effective field theory, but in non-relativistic format. In non-relativistic effective field theory, the Hamiltonian can be given as a summation between different isospin operators. And here Ci are Wilson coefficient, and these are different operators. And these operators can be constructed based on these six three vectors. These two obviously are identity, this is momentum dependent, this is velocity, and these two are spin of dark matter and target. Now, using these vectors, we can get 15 distinct operators, which any higher operators always can be constructed in terms of these lower operators. And among this operator one and operator four, both are velocity and momentum independent, and the rest have some dependency to velocity and momentum. This is the general relation for differential rate, sorry, differential cross-section per record energy, which is proportional to the amplitude of interactions. And as was pointed out by Migdal in 1986, the amplitude of interactions can be given in terms of Wilson loops. So taking this point into account, we can rewrite interactions in terms of different types of interactions and the form factor and nuclear response function. Now these are the relevant nuclear response function or form factor in terms of different operators. Operator 1, 5, 8, and 11 are spin independent, and the rest are spin dependent. In the case of helium-3, we have these three relevant form factors, which can be expanded in terms of different Wilson coefficients. The two first are spin dependent, and the last one is spin independent. Since operator 4 and operator 1 are both velocity and momentum independent, first I focus on operator 4 and operator 1, and then we'll try to expand it to all other operators. In the case of operator 4, the differential cross-section per record energy is proportional to the summation of different isospin and isoscalar operators of operator 4, Wilson coefficient of operator 4, and this nuclear response function, which can be given identically in terms of this structure function. And the same structure we can have for spin independent, but it's only related to the Wilson coefficient of operator 1, and it can be given in terms of a structure function for spin independent. Now the next step is to decompose proton and neutron contributions. If we assume proton and neutron are two orthogonal states or vector, then the Wilson coefficient related to proton and neutron can be given in terms of different isoscalar and isovector required. And the same structure can be applied to the structure function for spin dependent and spin independent. For spin dependent, we can decompose it in proton only, neutron only, and proton neutron interactions. And for spin independent is more simpler and is just related to Fn and Fp. Now using these relations and the previous slide, we can find the correlation between C operators and A and F parameters. These are the relevant nuclear response function for helium-3. As you can see here, they are symmetric, and because of this symmetric feature, the contribution of proton is getting cancelled out, and we remain only with contribution of neutron only. And with a simple quantum mechanical exercise, we can get this mean spin of neutron and proton in helium-3, and setting Jn½, we can end up with a total spin of helium-3 equivalent to half. Now collecting all relation that I have shown so far, and using this relation, we can find the correlation between Wilson coefficient of operator 4 and cross section. Now using this relation, we can find differential cross section per record energy and differential rate per record energy for spin dependent interactions. And for spin independent, the same structure can be followed. these are the relevant nuclear response function, and using these relations, we can find the correlation between C1 and cross-section for spin-independent traction. And finally, we can find these differential rates and cross-section for spin-independent. Using this structure, we can find the correlation between all different Wilson coefficients in terms of different cross-sections of spin-independent and spin-dependent. Using this, we expect to get two degenerate sets, one for spin-independent and spin-dependent in the form factor. But when we take out the factor of momentum and velocity out, then we should see the hierarchy between all different operators. And the last thing that we need to take care of for differential rate is performing this integration over a Boltzmann distribution, which is related to Vmin, which is the minimum velocity in order to excite a nuclear recoil. And here in this function for FV, we use an array of velocities to consider on physical astrophysical uncertainties, starting from 498 kilometer per second up to 608 kilometer per second. This plot showing different form factors in terms of dark matter mass for different operators. As you can see here, operator one and operator four are the highest one. And now if we take the form factor for operator for dark matter mass around one, we can get this differential rate per recoil energy for all different operators. Here, cross section is chosen to be in order of 10 to minus 36. As you can see here, operator one and operator four are the highest one. That's why here we focus on the, for now, on operator one and operator four. In the case of operator four, we consider this array of dark matter masses, and we can get this result for a differential rate per recoil energy. And the first line is corresponding to the lowest mass, and the last line here is corresponding to 10 GeV. As you can see here, each lines are split into three, and these are showing different escape velocities. And the signal simulation for spin-independent is very similar to spin-dependent one, but generally is slightly higher. Now using this signal simulation, we can go to the next step and toward finding projection sensitivity for QSTMC detector. This detector contains two different sectors of mixing chamber and Cooper demagnetization, and the whole thing will be located in Perovskite's refrigerator. This refrigerator contains, totally it has the height of 3 meters and contains five cells of polymetry target, each containing not 1 gram of helium-3 superfluid, which they need to be cooled down up to temperature below 100 microkelvin, which is the required temperature to gain superfluid. The cool down system consists of three different stages. In the first stage, helium-3 gas is going through liquid nitrogen and reach a temperature around 70 Kelvin, and then going through helium-4 gas and reach a temperature around 4.2 Kelvin. In this stage, helium-3 gas is getting pressurized and get the form of liquid and then pump into dilution refrigerator. Oh, sorry, can you please turn off your microphone?
Sorry, what?
Because somebody is sneezing and...
Maybe you have your microphone?
Yeah.
No. Your mom was.
Okay.
It's fine. Yes. Is it still a problem for you? Like, it's fine for us.
Okay, no, it's all okay. For some time, I cannot hear. Okay. So, in this stage, So liquid nitrogen is pumped into dilution refrigerator, which is containing helium-3 and helium-4 mixing chamber. In this stage, there are several heat exchange and flow resistance tubes that at the end we can gain a temperature around 2 millikelvin. And in the last stage, we have nuclear stage, which is based on nuclear demagnetization. And here, a magnetic field operates. In the presence of magnetic field, the energy levels of copper, which is here, escalates into 4 due to Zeeman effect, and all energy levels are equivalently populated at high temperature. But at lower temperature, around 2 millikelvin, which is induced by dilution refrigerator, the lowest energy level become energetically more favorable. And now if we keep entropy constant and just reduce magnetic field up to 50 millitesla, then you see energy levels are getting squeezed and temperature drops below 100 microkelvin. This is the temperature that we needed to gain superfluid helium-3. This a plot showing different phases of helium-3. As you can see here, if temperature and pressure are low enough, then we can get a superfluid helium-3 phase B. In work package 1, we are just dealing with helium-3 phase B, which is isotropic and stable. But in work package 2 also, we are dealing with helium-3A and transition between these two phases. This phase is not stable and it's not is anisotropic. Now, when dark matter incidents over a helium-3 target in bolometer, it can generate two different types of energy in the form of heat and photon. Photon can be detected using a silicon multiplier technology, and this photon detector will be located around here in this purple box. This is something ongoing. And heat will be generated using heat, which is generated by excitation of quasi particles, can be detected using the bolometer here. And this bolometer measures any temperature changes. And these temperature changes can hint us at the presence of dark matter. This bolometer is instrumented with a vibrating nanowire, and this nanowire is subjected to this magnetic field B and is driven with AC current and oscillates with frequency omega. And this wire, which is subjected to magnetic field B and moving with velocity V, can realize the force on each of the elements equivalent with this DF and the and voltage equivalent to this Y. Now if we integrating along the length of wire, then we can realize the total force and voltage proportional to current, the length of wire and magnetic field, and for voltage proportional to velocity, the length of wire and magnetic field. Now, when this nanowire is rotating on its way, it can experience a damping force due to interactions with quasi-particles. So consequently, we can observe a pulse in the voltage, as you can see here, over time, and a similar pulse can be seen in the response in terms of frequency. And here in this plot, the blue line is in phase, which is related to image. Real part, and the red one is out of phase and is related to imaginary part. Now the wire response can be parameterized in terms of this delta F and the amplitude of this peak. This.
So should I understand like the nanowire, like how long is this nanowire?
Sorry, I didn't hear you. Can you please speak louder?
Yeah, like what's the length of this nanowire?
It's smaller than, I will show you later, it is smaller than a 1 centimeter.
So like, and it is rotating inside the superfluid?
This one is rotating inside superfluid.
Inside the superfluid. I
Yes.
see. Okay, thank you.
And sorry, what's its threshold for the detector? So,
Sorry, I didn't, can you please?
and what sets the threshold? So here you're showing the
So
response, a signal. So
I will show you everything just step by step, okay? Just there, everything happens at once, so I have to go one by one into slides. Okay. This plot here showing this delta F over time and this peak just corresponding to this peak here, which is normalized to start from 0 temperature. And the wire constant and volumetric constant to ex get excited is around 85, 0.85 second and 0.24 second. Now, using this variation for a given temperature and pressure, the variation of this delta F can give us energy deposition. To just give you a real sense, these are our volumetric cells, which they are very small. And this is a zoomed-in picture of nanowire, which made of niobium and titanium and has around 180 nanometers diameter. And there are two copper legs, which copper is chosen in order to be able to pair with niobium and titanium. Now, energy deposition in helium, superfluid helium-3 can be found in four different formats: quasi particles, heat, singlet, triplet, and infrared photons. And the fractions of energy deposition is different for nuclear recoil and electron recoil. And the highest contribution is coming from quasi particles in both of them, and generally this one is higher than this one. And everything below this one is just quasi particles. The next step is our reading out techniques. Vibrating nanowire can be read out using two different techniques. The first one is transformer, which is a con the conventional one, and the other one is a squid. And at the end, both of them can be read with a locking amplifier. In locking amplifier, the input signal, including its amplitude and phase, can be compared with a reference signal, and we can extract a signal of a noisy background. And SQuid here is a short name for superconducting quantum interference device, which this device connects to a detector inductively and is a magnetometer sensitive to 10 to minus 14 Tesla. And this can convert a magnetic flux, which is induced by a magnetic field in a nanowire, into the voltage. And this voltage finally can be read out using a locking amplifier. Now, any uncertainties on the energy measurement has a direct impact on the threshold scale. And these uncertainties are related to our reading out technique or quasi particles production fluctuations, and also the shot noise from incidence of quasi particles to nanowire. Using a squid, which is based on this purple one, we can reduce readout noise and reducing energy threshold, and consequently, we can have a higher dark matter sensitivity. For conventional readout, we need to follow three different lines here: the red, orange, and gray one, which we reach to threshold around 39 electron volts, and for A squid readout, we need to follow orange, purple, and gray one, and we reach to a threshold around 0.71 electrons.
But can I
yes.
ask you about that before? So if
yes.
you had perfect readout, then what will set the threshold of the detector? Because naively I will say, well, the threshold, the fundamental threshold is just the binding energy of the Cooper pairs of the superfluid helium 3. But it's probably not that, right? It's probably something to do
yes,
with
because
the
wire. The energy threshold, the energy that you need to break superfluid helium 3 to break copper pair is in order of 10 to minus 7 electron volt.
Exactly. So it must be something with the wire itself that the.
There are many different factors. It's like the length of wire, it's a diameter, and even temperature. There are different factors, but so far, the lowest threshold which we could achieve, it was 39 using conventional readout, and a squid readout is around 0.71.
Yeah, so may I ask, like, where does the short noise come from here?
Short noise is incidence of nanowire to quasi particles, so it produces a noise. Okay. Now, helium-3 itself, it's super pure because it's a super fluid, which is super cold. And it doesn't have any impurities. But the material that make up the detector, or even particles that's coming from outer space, they can interfere and producing a sound. And can produce some background. And these backgrounds are in the form of cosmic rays, radiogenics, and neutrinos. To estimate cosmic rays, we use a Cry and Dent for simulation and assuming 90% better efficiency and no shielding. And for radiogenics, we estimating using material screening and Dent for. And as you can see here, using cosmic rays or cosmic rays and radiogenics, we have the highest contribution, and the lowest one is related to neutrino NRs and ERs, and even neutrino ER is constant, so it can be separated easily. Now, combining this background model with a response model and signal simulation, we can find the limit over our projection sensitivity. This is the result for a spin-dependent neutron interaction. The dashed line here is related to a Questa squid. This dotted line is related to a conventional method. And our score is around 10 to minus 37 up to 500 dV for a squid readout. The same result, similar result is produced for a spin independent projection sensitivity based on 6 months runs and 5 cells of helium 3 cells. And still, for this one, for squid, we get to lower region in order of 10 to minus 38 and around 500 MeV. Now, the next step that I want to show today is the air shadowing. Each dark matter particle, which is reaching to the detector, need to pass through three different regions: atmosphere, air, and shield. For atmosphere, we need to consider all the stopping effects by oxygen and nitrogen. But since our detector is in surface, we do not need to consider air, and our material around the detector is minimal. So for now, we don't need to assume any shielding. This plot here showing the final velocity at the detector in terms of initial velocity at the top of atmosphere, for dark matter mass around 1 GeV and cross section around 10 to minus 25. When there is no air shadowing effect, we expect to have this dashed line. But when we have air shadowing effect, we get this deviation from dashed line. And this final velocity here can be parameterized in terms of initial velocity plus integration over the trajectory of dark matter. And L is just a straight pass line from the top atmosphere to the detector. This can affect the signal simulation and consequently our projection sensitivity. So here, this function, the Boltzmann distribution, which is related to this function here, receive additional angle delta, which is proportional to three different angles. The azimuthal angle phi just can be integrated out and remain with two in, angles. Gamma is angle between the norm of mean of velocity and the norm of detector, and theta is this angle. And since our detector is on surface, here the depth and D is equivalent to zero. This is the Boltzmann distribution with velocity at the detector as a function of final velocity at the detector. The dashed line here is the result without air shadowing, but when we assume air shadowing for different values of cross section, we see we get higher peaks in lower velocities. And these different lines are corresponding to different values of gamma. And all values below this region are not energetic. The dark matter is not energetic enough to be able to excite a nuclear recoil. Notice having these deviations can impact our differential rate, recoil energy. This is the result for a spin-dependent interaction. And the solid lines are without air shadowing, and the dashed lines are with air shadowing. And for different, and this result is produced for cross-section around 10 to minus 25 and different dark matter masses. And as you can see here, we have some deviation from the original line, and this deviation needs to be taken into account. The only thing that here we need to take into account, that I here I produce another plot for spin independent, that the differential rate for air shadowing always needs to be smaller than the one without air shadowing. For example, here, the red one is the result with air shadowing, which is higher than this original one, so it's out, and we just need to consider all below, like this green one. Taking this point into account, we can find the higher limit over a spin-independent dark matter nucleon limit, which reach up to cross section around 10 to minus 27. And this is the limit that we get for dark matter neutron interaction, which we reach up to cross section around 10 to minus 24 centimeters squared. Today I discussed QSTMC detector, which is a superfluid helium-3 bolometer instrumented with vibrating nanowire, and we aim to set a world-leading sensitivity to GeV and sub-GeV dark matter mass with electron volt scale energy threshold. We have set limits for both spin-dependent and spin-independent cross-section and event rate, and our score for spin-dependent, for example, is in order of 10 to minus 37 at 500 MeV and with threshold around 0.71 electron volt with using a squid readout. But today also I discuss air shadowing effect, which can impact our higher limit for projection sensitivity. And recently, we have published this paper with the title QuestMC Superfluid Helium 3 Detector for Sub-GeV Dark Matter. Please visit this paper. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? You mean like this is already like with real data that you collected already?
Some part, yes, some part is simulation.
So like the shaded region is experimentally excluded?
This one.
Yeah.
This one, this shaded region is the result based on air shadowing. So without considering air shadowing, you have only these plots. But when you have air shadowing, you have some deviation in a signal simulation, which can impact these cross sections. So you can get this one entirely.
I'm just asking, is it real data or projection?
Oh, these are projection sensitivity.
But these are all projections with the...
Yes. Yeah. As you can see here, those which are the real one are solid, and those which are dashed or dot always are projection.
So what's the timeline for running this experiment?
It's around 6 months.
But when do you think the experiment can actually run?
Everything is still ongoing. I think very soon, not really. Everything is ongoing. I do not have any more information about it.
Okay, so like in the lab, like how much like a helium 3 do you have in the end? 1 gram or?
Oh, sorry, can you please repeat your question?
What's the total mass you are going to have actually in the lab?
What total mass do we have in the lab?
How much helium 3 do you have like actually in the lab?
It's like, do you ask about how much helium 3 do we have in the lab?
Yes.
It's just five cells, each containing not 1 gram of helium 3.
So my question is like, is the surface effect important or like it's like the bulk computation are all good?
You mean if we have detector in surface or underground?
No. Like the, I mean, like you have like a small box and there's
so obviously
it's living on the surface.
It has some effect on exposure when they are smaller. So the exposure is smaller, so it has some effect. Obviously, if it is bigger, it would be better.
Probably no questions. I see no questions from Zoom, so
yeah,
we can thank the speaker.
Yeah. Thank you.